Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. I'm so glad that we're able to chat this evening because I am going to take you back in history to the 1800s. You may say, why in the world are we going back there? Well, my guest, Marianne Traill, has done something that's very, very special, I think. You know, here we are, it's summertime, you want a good read. How would you like to be taken in the time machine of the book? Yes, a time machine that takes you back into an era where anything was easy. Was it easy? I don't think so. Well, Marianne Traill has put together a series, and the first in her series is Their Chilling Fall. Marianne Traill, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
Marianne, you have taken upon yourself to put together a series, and each of the characters in your books are just absolutely incredible. But this very first book that you have that I received, that I said, oh my goodness, there is so much to this story and the list of characters that you have. What fascinated you about that time period? Why is it you became so captivated with the 1800s?
Well, not just the 1800s, but the early 1800s. Later 1800s were very Victorian and became very stifling. I think from my research that the early 1800s was like the last hurrah for women to have some sense of freedom. Also, there was an awful lot of similarities to current events politically, with wars going on and countries being invaded and so forth. There was just a lot to grab as a historian. So I started writing in that time period, and as my characters moved on in different experiences, I just moved, you know, a couple of years down the road. And I'm still finding times and things of interest to show my readers that living in that time period is hard, but it had a lot of benefits to it also.
America at that time was in, I would call, a very progressive period in many respects. When it came to women and their roles, those roles were pretty much categorized. But in the American environment, so many of those women were entering into experiences. I think of Abigail Adams. You know, her husband, John Adams, is off in Europe. He's a politician, and he was over there for years, not just for a week or two. It was years he spent overseas.
That's absolutely right. Women had to take on they always had responsibilities that far outweighed just the image we have of them sitting home twiddling their fingers or their embroidery. They had to run things. They had to run the farm, raise the children, often while the husband was out doing something else. I mean, Adams was always a lawyer. I mean, I don't think he was ever a farmer. He wasn't home all that much.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That is true. And I really appreciated the fact that the women, many times, were totally ignored. And the, put it terms bluntly, as it would have been termed then, the lower classes. There wasn't really much of a middle class, but in the 1800s, there was a middle class developing. And this is something that many people are not aware of. The economy, the infrastructure of business. But in reading your book, Their Chilling Fall, my goodness, I thought about that, and I thought about the transportation and everything else that goes on. You had to have put in many hours of research. Where did you go for your research? I know libraries are available, but you are living in an environment that's close to a lot of historical places, aren't you?
Well, I was thinking about being interviewed and what kinds of questions might come up, and I realized that one of the answers to where the research was done is that every place in my books I have visited. So in this case, in the Chilling Fall, where all the activity takes place in Cape Breton, and the family is trying to move from London to Boston, and there's a shipwreck. So they end up in Cape Breton. Now, my husband and I spent several weeks there at different times, visited a number of the sites that are mentioned in the book. There's a living history museum there that showed houses and buildings from the time period. So that kind of research always adds, I think, something to the background of what you're writing. Then I went to sources in the library, diaries, things like that. There's not a lot from that time period, which actually makes it easier to work in. And the other thing I like to use a lot are maps of a particular area to give you a feel for how people moved around certain areas. And admittedly, in Cape Breton, there is not really anything in the way of maps with the detail that one would hope you'd find. But there was enough to be able to tell that, you know, they needed to walk 25 miles through the woods to get from one place to another. And I think that kind of stuff adds a background to a situation, and it helps it become a little more real to people.
I agree. And you have two primary characters. You have Jeffrey and Georgina that the book opens up with. And I was so intrigued with the character Georgina. This is a woman that had been well-trained in social niceties. She had come from what you would consider the upper class environment. So this is someone, she's quite attractive, and the ship that they're on ends up, you know, getting into a very dangerous situation, and all of the people on the ship have to be taken off and put into land as quickly as possible because this is a very dangerous situation. And I could see her in these long dresses and having to manage this. And the way she was able, and in the book, you know, it's a fascinating evolution, an adaptation that she was able to do. And her husband was very, very much of, you might say, a much broader awareness of people, environments, etc. But this was even a bit out of what he had experienced in the past, even though he was a seaman and an officer and all of these different things that come out about his quality of character. But she was quite amazing in her adaptability and being able to deal with different things and sort of, you might say, roll with the punches of disillusionment and realizing she's not in Kansas anymore, taking a quote from The Wizard of Oz with Dorothy.
Yeah, she wasn't going to sit around and wait for somebody to wait on her because nobody would.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I love about writing is that these characters are very real to me, but I can make them do what I want so that in this case, I didn't want her sitting around waiting for somebody to wait on her. I wanted her to be an independent woman who suddenly got into a situation where she could actually show some of her skills and mm-hmm. her emotion and her adaptability. Besides which, she's passionately in love with Jeffrey, and she wants him to think well of her. So she's going to do whatever she thinks he needs done.
Mm-hmm. But she's not, the interesting thing about these two characters are they both care for each other very deeply, but they are, you might say, opposites in some ways because of their roles in life. However, they're willing to listen to each other. They're willing to think about what the other person is saying. And that is very, very important. And Jeffrey is considered the leader, and rightfully so. And then you have the character Patty, who is very, very interesting. And you have a little girl, and actually two little girls that are involved in this. And there is so much, I would say, drama and intrigue right in the very, very beginning, because here you have all of these people that are taken off of a ship and their personalities are so diverse. How in the world did you ever keep this straight?
Oh, my computer is set up in front of cork boards, and I have lists all over the place. And I still have the drawing of the ship and what the bunks looked like, and how much you could see if you went down the stairs, of who was in the bunk and so forth. So that I tried to be as real as possible. But again, being able to identify with the people who are in your main characters, the little girls are actually based on my granddaughters. And I did that intentionally, thinking that would be a good way for me to identify more with my granddaughters. I could interview them. I could ask them how the girls should act in the book and so forth. And my granddaughters were really helpful. I would say, well, this is happening. How would you experience that? What would you say? And they became so, I was going to, adopt them out at the end of the book. And then I just realized that they were almost as popular as Jeffrey and Georgina, and I'd better not get rid of them. So my own granddaughters are now in their teens, and they're still feeding me information. So it's worked out really well on both counts.
Well, that is fascinating, because you think here we are in 2026 and you're talking about the 1800s and this the early 1800s. And you would think with that much difference in time, there wouldn't be that kind of, gee whiz, this is the way kids think or young people think or young adults think. And the truth is the patternings are very similar, are they not?
Well, I don't know for sure, because, I actually have not lived in 1805, but I don't see why they wouldn't be similar. I mean, you go through a lot of the same stages in life, puberty and the first love, and, these little girls lost their parents. That's traumatizing. And, how were they going to handle that and move on? Those kinds of things happen today.
Mm-hmm.
Not as often, thank God, but, so that's one of the ways I did research for how the characters were going to respond, is to look at today's experience and see if it was transferable.
Well, this is not just a historical novel, but you've also made it a murder mystery, which is fascinating. Because here are all of these people that are stranded in an area that they have no knowledge of. It's beginning, it's in the fall period, but this is an environment that is not a friendly environment at all. And you just don't know what's around you. You've landed somewhere that is totally foreign to you, and you have to find out where maybe the nearest village is or camp or something to see what other people are in the area, because there's nothing visible, nothing visible. So go ahead.
That group was based on a real group of people that moved from Scotland to Canada. They were moving, their intended result was going to be to land in Halifax, which is farther down the coast, and move up the Canadian mainland, probably near Toronto or Montreal. So there were a number of shipwrecks where these people got dumped into a Nova Scotia, and they didn't have the money to go further, so that they did make a living there, farming or fishing or doing something like that. So they had an idea of it. You know, they knew a little bit about Canada, where they were going. But I think they were kind of shocked at really how rural that particular area was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's always a surprise. And again, when we're looking at our time today, this year, 2026, we're celebrating the 250th anniversary of the United States. We have the situation, you know, the association with Canada, but it was nothing at all. I mean, nobody had at that time any idea of the evolution that would be occurring in the United States and in Canada. These are pioneers, to be perfectly frank. These are people that are coming in to this environment because they want a better life. They are leaving something that is downright ugly for them back in their own country. And
you know, there was an awful lot of Americans who went up, well, in the 1776, in Boston alone, they pushed out all the loyalists. Some of them went to England because they had money, but most of them didn't have that kind of money. And a lot of them went to Canada, and a large group of them ended up in Nova Scotia.
Hmm.
So there was a real influx of Americans at this time period into that particular area. It was all our rejects.
All of our rejects.
Well, they weren't rejects, but I mean, you know, they were pushed out of Boston and New England particularly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because those are areas that had been settled and they had their class distinction. And they did the very same thing, because a lot of the people that came into America in the very beginning, before we became a nation, they were from the aristocracy or from that environment. And they said, hey, we like it here. So they carried with them all of the disciplines and the behaviors and attitudes that they'd had from overseas. And that's the case with all of us. Whenever we go into a new environment, we're going to carry with us whatever we are, in whatever level, mental, physically, emotionally, spiritually, we're going to carry that with us into those environments we choose to be a part of. And that's exactly what happened. And a lot of people that went into this area that your book is so vividly descriptive of, that is something that they did. And so you have all of these different personalities, and you even have a murderer. But the murderer is one that was on the ship that came in. And there is a plot in this book that is absolutely wonderful. And I say that, excuse me, I'm not condoning murder, but for a murder mystery writer, I think that this is what really creates a sense of magic, because there has to be that process of elimination. But sometimes that process of elimination doesn't work until certain circumstances will evolve and you're able to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And it was quite a challenge for Jeffrey and those that were close to him. His men were very, very loyal to him. Georgina was someone who was adaptable. She was an observer. She was sort of like the assistant detective, because she could talk with the women in the village that she became acquainted with. And just her observation skills are just outstanding. And they dovetailed with Jeffrey's, because of both of them, they eventually were able to find out the truth.
And yet,
go ahead.
You know, they are a little bit different from a lot of the Regency novels, which I'm really trying to make a differentiation. They are supposedly upper middle class. They're not royalty. They don't have titles. I mean, he's got a title because, you know, he was in the military. But I was trying to look at what life might be like for, you know, the average, or maybe the average person with a bit of money,
mm-hmm.
rather than the upper class.
Yes, I would call that the middle class myself. That's what I would call, because they've got money, they're comfortable.
Yeah. I'm sorry, say again?
I said, because they have the money and they are comfortable. They're not poor. They can afford things. But they have to be prudent. They have to be thoughtful about what they do. But they still are comfortable. They're not super rich, but they're comfortable. And that's what I call average. That's the middle class. That's the middle class. And even the middle class has different levels to it. But the truth is, they had where the young girls that they had with them were have-nots and had been exposed to some pretty rough situations, very traumatized. So, you know, the stories of these two people represent, I think, what so many people feel is just absolutely a part of what they earn and that they have the right to experience. They're not slaves. They are individuals that are making choices, and they have the opportunity to make those choices.
You just make me feel so good. I really appreciate your input about how my characters developed.
Yes, well, one of the aspects that I think anyone that is wise will say, I have to assess my environment. Now, here we are in a time frame, and you mentioned it earlier, going from one point to another. Patty is out there, and he is walking. Now, if he's lucky enough to have a horse, but I love the part about him being on a horse, and he hadn't been on a horse for, I think, quite a long time, and the description of how he felt after riding a while, and the guy who was with him, I loved that. I said, yes, I can totally feel his pain and his agony.
That was from a conversation with my brother, of all people, who told me, I guess I was asking him if riding a horse would give a guy a problem after a number of hours. And we had a whole conversation about how you feel after you've not been on a horse when you get on one for a long time. So I'm really glad that came through.
It did.
I've had such interesting conversations with people about things, about different areas, like riding a horse or fishing or rocking in a boat or, stuff like that. Can you load a gun when you're running? That sort of thing.
And you look at the living conditions and you bring that out in the book. And this is something that I think is so important, because we take so much for granted today. We have an infrastructure that our ancestors, if any of these people came back, they'd say, whoa, you can just turn the lights on. Or, oh, my goodness, you don't have to worry about using the outhouse. There's just all of these aspects that we take for granted. So immersing yourself, I think, in a historical novel and being aware of what soldiers went through in barracks. Now, we're in a part of the country where the winters are brutal, and people have to really prepare food and have things set in preservation in some way. Otherwise, they're going to die of starvation. They don't have a 7-Eleven or a Safeway or an Albertsons or whatever your favorite store is that's going to be available for them to just hop in a vehicle and go down and get their gallon of milk. Excuse me, no, you better have a cow. And you've got to deal with the waste from the cow, and you have to deal with keeping an area for the animal clean. And then you're in a place, and you describe it well. You must have seen these barracks. I call them barracks, that Georgina and the girls were in. It didn't even have a fireplace. There was nothing, nothing there for them to be able to keep themselves warm. And they finally were moved to a place where they were able to stay and at least have a fire. But there were
conditions for military, for army guys. Mm-hmm. Horrible. Just horrible.
what the men go through and went through then and compared to even what they have today. I was in an old barracks here in Washington, and this was a couple of years ago, and they were stifling. You didn't have any, you know, the windows, during the winter, you didn't dare open them. You didn't have heaters in a room. You didn't have any of that. And very bare, very, very bare. And you describe what it was like for the soldiers. And their life was hard. It was very, very hard. And
I saw a bed with a flat piece of board.
Mm-hmm.
It actually had some edging on it. That was for four guys were supposed to sleep there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't get your own bed. So maybe it was a little bit warmer with them all sleeping together, but
mm-hmm.
it certainly did not look particularly appealing.
Well, the thing was, people would sleep head to toe. I mean, it wasn't unusual in poor families that four or five people slept in a bed, and especially with the children. The children, were in that position.
About the box bed.
Oh, the box bed was adorable. I loved that. That was something that was so much fun. But that was done in Europe. That was the only way to have any kind of privacy. That's why they had the curtains around it and all of that. And even today, people are fascinated with that.
This box bed that I saw in Cape Breton actually was made out of wood.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very real, and it had a sliding door. And it looked just bloody awful.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. it was small. I mean, there was no way a normal person could stretch out.
Well, we're
Jeffrey's supposed to be 6 foot tall.
Mm-hmm.
And,
and
he'd be sleeping across it.
That's right. And it is something with those beds. And whenever you have a chance to be in an antique environment, you'll find that the chairs that often were used in parlors were quite small. And that's because the women were much smaller. Well, our women today are so much bigger, and that has to do with nutrition. That
mm-hmm.
is something that among the Asian population, because of the foods that they had access to, depending on where they lived, let's say in China or in different environments, the foods that they were eating, they had a very, very small size. The women were very, very small and very, very tiny. Well, they didn't have the food. When I was a girl, I'll never forget seeing someone that was Chinese and looking at the young men and realizing that they were bigger. Why was that? Well, they weren't Samoans, which were very big people, but Samoans ate pork and all kinds of different seafood, and they were a very vigorous people, but it's the protein factor. And so in America, having a chicken in a pot every week, that was luxury for the average person because that wasn't
uh-huh.
something easily available. But when you have those populations that have had meat and have had the protein aspect, and I know there's some people listening to me say, Donna, you're not a vegetarian. That's true, I'm not. But these are facts. This isn't something that's made up. The diet often will encourage them the bodies to be bigger and stronger. And I saw that myself many years ago, and it fascinated me, absolutely fascinated me, that the dietary patterns made a difference. And in early America, that was the big case. Most people in America had a hard time in the 1800s. They had a more difficult time even in the 1700s. But you go into these time frames and you realize they had to be self-sufficient to a degree. If they were not, they would starve to death, absolutely starve to death. And this is mm-hmm. something that came out in your story relative to the environment that all of these people, Jeffrey, Georgina, the children, all of these different characters that you put together in the book of their chilling fall, their dress, what was acceptable, what wasn't acceptable, what were the protocols, and finding the murderer who was extraordinarily clever, and then finding persons murdered And it didn't make any sense. Why was this person killed and this other person? Why was this done? For what reason? It took a real good investigation. And we're dealing not with forensics like fingerprints and all kinds of things. That just wasn't truly available then. But by golly, there is a lot of story and drama in
One of the reasons I wanted to have a mystery in there was for people who will come to you and say, I don't read history. I wanted to have something that would make them, if you had to spoon feed them history, that was what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted them to get a feel for what it was like to live in the time period. And if the only way to do it was to have a mystery to keep them interested, then I'm really glad it seems to work.
It did work, and it worked big time. And I think when I finished reading your book, and this is the first one in this series, Their Chilling Fall, Marianne, when I finished reading this, I thought I learned so much about aspects of that time frame, Canada, America. I mean, we're so much alike. The Canadians and the Americans are very much alike in so many ways. And when I was reading that, I thought, really, no matter what culture you go into, you find that the stories of human beings overcoming corruption and abuse in different ways, being kind and thoughtful and people working together as a community and those that get scared that don't want change. My goodness, look at what's happening today. We're going through, just like you mentioned at the beginning, the almost the same kind of patterning. We're just in different costumes.
It's frightening.
Mm-hmm.
It's really frightening.
But at the same time, Marianne, think about it. Those people survived. So will we. But it makes us, when we become aware of history, we have to say, wait a minute, do we want to repeat the same mistakes that our ancestors did or could have done? Do we want to do that? I don't think so. So
no, I don't either. The Americans invaded Canada 3 times and got beat back all 3.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's a good reason for that. Good reason for that. But there you go. The same kind of thinking. And you say to yourself, how is it that we go back into what I call the old patterns that were so suffocating to other people? Why do we want to go backwards instead of moving forward? And that is something that we really need to think about. And I believe that there are a lot of people that are saying, we're not going to go backwards. We're going to go forward, but we have to clean up our act first. Your book, Their Chilling Fall, Marianne Traill, you have another book, Their Winter Burn, and there is another book. You've got the series here, and you've also got one, His Solo Spring. So we're only talking about the very first one, but there we are going, there's all of these others. This series is fabulous. And you have book number 4 coming out. So
I do.
We're going to have another conversation later on. But I really think you've done such a phenomenal job with this series that it brings home a lot of historical information that I would say most of us have no idea about. And by the time I finished reading it, I said, okay, that's enough of that. Forget about it. I'll go, if ever there's a fair and I have a chance to wear a costume, great. I'll design the costume, but forget about it. I want my shower. I want my hot water. I want to be able to do the things. I like my vacuum cleaners, my washing machines, and all of this other stuff. It made me think, I'm so grateful I'm living in this era.
You forgot your coffee pot.
Oh, yes, we can't forget that. I'm a tea person myself. So I
Well,
really related to the tea that was being discussed in the book and the business of tea. And that's another thing. You cover business as well and the way people worked and how they did things. No, it's a wonderful read, Marianne. Now you have your website and it's your name, Mary
that's
Ann
right.
Trail and Mary Ann Trail. com, and people will find out so much about what you're doing and your writing and your other books. And are these books also available on Amazon?
They are.
Okay.
In fact, that's the only, unless you apply to me directly, they are available on Amazon. The backstory for Georgina and Jeffrey is actually I'm giving it away free on my website. It's
Really?
book two, Facing Enemy.
Ah,
So if you want to know
okay.
how they met, that's all in there.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Right now, I'm running a special on their Chilling Fall. It's at a reduced price on Amazon.
Oh my goodness, that is absolutely wonderful, Marianne. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm looking forward to our next conversation because Jeffrey and Georgina, as well as the two little girls that they save, their parents die, and that's very traumatic for the youngest child. But I really think you give an insight into the life of children at that time. And boy, have times changed. But anyway, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Thank you so very much, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Well, thank you. I am also looking forward to it. I appreciate it very much.
It is my pleasure. We are saying goodbye to Marianne Trail, and I'm going to just take a moment to thank those of you who are regular listeners, and also for those of you that are joining us for the first time. I just appreciate your taking the time to listen to the stories of people that I interview on my programming. And I focus on authors because they actually take the time to write out what their experiences are. So this is something that I'm very grateful I'm able to share this. We're in our 25th year of programming. And I want to say that our television shows are up on the Donna Sebo television show network that's up on YouTube. All the videos are there of my television programming and they're available 24/7. The program is titled Special Editions, and we have a very eclectic arrangement of subject matter and interviews. And the people that I feature typically are authors themselves. So you have that is available as well as my radio programming 24/7, and I have the player on my network page that you can go into again anytime, any place, anywhere, and listen to the latest 13 to 15 hours of programming, one show right after the other. So we are going to be moving along here, but I also wanted to mention for those of you that are authors, or if you have a book that is going to be coming out and you'd like to be considered as a guest on the radio show or the television show or even both, all you have to do is send me an email through my website, which is DelphiInternational.com. Go to the contact page, and on that contact page, then you will be able to send me a message, and that will enable me then to be able to respond to you. When you send me a book, and I actually need the book, I do not read PDFs. It's very important that you include in that book when you send it your phone number, your email, and your website information. It is surprising to me how many authors do not put contact information into their books. And I'm not saying you have to put all of it in, but there has to be a way for me to be able to reach you. And if your website isn't operating, then again, I need to know how else I could reach you. Some people change their email, not realizing that when they change their email, people aren't going to be able to reach them, especially someone that, like me, that's a talk show host. So be sure you take the time, if you're going to send me a book or if you have a friend that would like to be interviewed, send me a copy of the book, send me your contact information with the book. Right now, I have, and I'm not exaggerating, hundreds of books that I have had submissions from, and I'm not able to do all of them, but if you have that contact information where I can reach you quickly, because I actually read the material that's sent to me, that is phenomenally valuable, and it enables me to be in touch with you. So I just wanted to be sure to mention that, and don't forget the author showcase. You have there in the showcase people who have supported my programming financially, and what they have done is they have put their, we've got their interviews, whether it's radio, television, and maybe both they have done with me. All of that is available to you as well. And all you have to do is go in to Author Showcase, you tap on the information, and bingo, you have got the connection with them that you need. And it's just right there on your at your fingertips. So it's really terrific. Well, I wanted to share with you, I know what I wanted to mention to you. If you would really like to have what I would call an in-depth experience with what it was like to live in the 1800s, there is at the library, I found this at the public library, it was a documentary that was done, and it was done in England, and it was done in, I think it's the late 1800s, and there was a theme that they wanted to do. This documentary was made into a series, and it involved a family. Now, what occurred with this, how this evolved, is somebody came up with the idea, what if we could find a place in London, let's say London, and housing, old housing that still exists, that was built in that time frame, and of course there is that, that's still available, and they found a place that was not occupied. They found the old, fireplace. They found the old gas lines that had supplied the lighting, because there was that enabled you would have a flame, you'd have to light the lamps. And they found all of this in a facility, in a building, and they were able actually to tear out what had been plastered over the fireplace and, you know, for modernization. Well, they found this location and they said, wouldn't it be great if we could have a family that would want to live like people lived in the late 1800s. Now, Mary Ann's book is an earlier time of the 1800s. So this is what they did. They actually put out a blast via media that they were looking for families. And they wanted families that were, you know, had children, obviously. But they wanted a husband, wife, and children that would be willing for 1 month to, I believe it was 1 month. I don't think it was 3 months, but I think it was 1 month. They were able to live as the people lived in the late 1800s. And they put this blast out. Well, they got thousands of people that responded, we'd love to do it. Well, they had to look at the ages of the people. They wanted a younger couple, let's say maybe in their late 20s, early 30s, somewhere in there. And they wanted children in the family to be of different ages. Well, the family that won out, husband and wife, and they had three children, two girls and a boy. One of the girls was in her early teens. The other one was younger, and the boy, I believe, was the youngest. This is titled, I think, something 1800s, or the 1800s life, and it's a video. So you might find it in the library. And again, it's a documentary. I was amazed. I was absolutely fascinated with the whole series, because this family was told, you will eat the way the people would eat. You will not be able to pick up a phone and call. All of this is going to be taken away because there wasn't the phone at the time. And you had to dress the way you were supposed to dress. The location, they were very clear. They let these people know that you were going to live as people lived in the 1800s. Now, this was sort of like a middle class kind of a level. And there was no toilet in the house. It was an outhouse that you had to use if you needed to go to the bathroom. Chamber pots were provided. There were all of these things that were going on. When I watched that show, it was so intriguing to me because we are so disassociated from the past, realizing what people had to do. At that time, people had to buy their meat from the peddlers that would sell meat, soap, all kinds of things. They didn't have shampoos like we've got. And the teenage daughter, they had cameras that were throughout the place, and the family members could go and talk to the camera. And this, again, was done years ago. And I was so intrigued, and I would just start to laugh, especially at the teenage girl, because she was accustomed to washing her hair every day. She was accustomed to taking a shower. She was accustomed to using deodorants. Well, you were not to have any of that. You were to use the soaps that were used. You were to do laundry. You were to do all kinds of things just like they did in that time frame, what the average family had to do. And it showed how the girls were kept back. They actually were not encouraged to go to school because they had to help the mother do the housework. And we're not talking about a big mansion here. We're talking about the average living condition. Laundry was done by hand, not by machine. And all of these different things that were experienced by the average family. Now, the man, the husband, he was put into a position of being in the military, and consequently he wasn't around. Well, the long and short of it is, the mother, the first time that a peddler for meat came to the house, now she was a vegetarian. She didn't eat meat. She was appalled at how they unwrapped the food, the meat, because it wasn't in plastic, it wasn't in a sanitary container, but you had the kidneys, you had the liver, you had all of this. It was wrapped, but not necessarily in what we would say today is absolutely mandatory. You have to keep things clean. Not the case then. Her son really had some major problems. In fact, I think he, if I remember correctly, he ended up having to be removed from the environment because he actually became ill. They didn't have but very little heat. They had all kinds of things they were dealing with, but the husband was in the military, so he was out most of the time. Well, the modern woman, his wife, was not too happy with that. And they came out of that with a much deeper appreciation of our time frame as we are experiencing it. And not only that, but to realize to wash your hair, you couldn't wash your hair every day. It just wasn't something that was done because it wasn't practical. You didn't have a hair dryer. You might have, you know, the little rollers that you made with cloth, but it was an entirely different world. And I smiled when I found out at the end of this experiment that the mother went with the family to McDonald's to have hamburgers, to have what she called real food. You know, there is so much of a difference. It really is a fascinating thing. So you might want to check at your library. I wish I could remember the exact title, but it is a documentary. It came into my mind. I watched it many years ago, and it is something I know in our public library that it was in the video section under the documentary label, and it was really eye-opening. So this is something for someone to go back into that time frame and what Marianne has done, and to bring forth all of this information about what it took, the thinking processes, the analyzation, medical factors that had to be dealt with. What do you do? How do you handle it? What do you do in emergencies? Now, this is just really fascinating to me. So I wanted to share that with you, because that documentary, if you're able to find it and to watch the filming that they did, and this was done in England, it was incredible. I'm not sure that it was through the BBC, but it might have been. It's been a number of years since I've seen it. But that registered in my mind, and it still makes me smile today. And I, pat my washing machine and my dryer and say, I love you. And I know that's a little bit, dramatic, but really, I'll tell you, I'm so grateful for the modernization that has occurred since then. And it is something we do need to take the time to appreciate it, because there's an infrastructure that goes behind that. And that infrastructure took a long time to build. Well, I've got some other things that I'm going to share with you, but you know what? I'm just going to sort of digress a moment here. And there was something that was sent to me. Let me see if I can find it. And I don't know about you, but every once in a while, my sweet tooth grabs on. Well, more than just once in a while. And it's funny how certain things will just taste absolutely fabulous. And other things, well, I can't find it. It was a card that one of my guests sent me. And it was on creating caramelized nuts with sugar. And I just thought it was such a simple recipe, and maybe you already know how to do that. So I thought, okay, I will just go ahead and I will shift to something else. I moved it. With this new equipment that I have been able to rearrange things. And I thought, oh, I found it. Okay, here we go. This is a very, very simple recipe. And having candied nuts, I know we can go to the store and buy it. But you could do something with different flavorings or different spices if you wanted. And you don't have to make up a big volume. If you're like me, if you have a whole bunch of candied pecans or walnuts or almonds, it's like, I'll just take one. And then the next thing you know, you're taking 2, 3, 4, 5, and half the jar of the box or whatever you brought it in is gone. So this really makes a very, very nice amount. And it makes a fabulous gift for someone. Absolutely fabulous. It's a great type of recipe, I think, that's really easy to do. So here you go. It's candied nuts. And yes, her name is Margaret. She sent it to me. Now, what you need is 3 cups of unsalted nuts, 1 large egg white, 1 tablespoon of water, 1/2 cup of granulated sugar, 1/2 cup of light brown sugar, 1 tablespoon of ground cinnamon, 1/4 teaspoon of ground nutmeg, and 1 teaspoon of kosher salt. So there you go. Now your oven needs to be preheated to 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and you want to have a big baking sheet. You want to line it with parchment paper, because this is sticky stuff. I like to use 2 levels of parchment paper. Now your nuts, you want to have a good sized bowl. And you want to have a separate bowl that you're going to put the egg white in and the water. So all your nuts go into the one big bowl. The separate bowl, you're going to whisk together the egg white and the water. And you're going to pour this mixture over your nuts. And you want to toss the nuts. You want to toss them well. You want to make sure that everything is coated. And then in another bowl, you're going to have your sugars, your cinnamon, your nutmeg, and your salt. and you're going to mix that together. Then all you do is add it to your bowl of nuts, toss it to cover everything completely. This is, like I said, really simple. Then you're going to add the nuts to your baking sheet, spread them evenly, bake them at 300 degrees for 15 minutes, take them out of the oven, toss them, and then you're going to bake those nuts at 300 degrees for another 15 minutes, and then you want to let them cool. Once that's done, you want to let them cool in the pan that they've been baked in before you break them up. And just let them cool completely, and then you want to store them in an airtight container. And like I said, it makes a wonderful gift, and you can have all kinds of containers. Maybe you've got some extras around the house and you want to give somebody something special, and you could do this. Now, I've known people that like spicy nuts. Well, this same procedure could be followed, and you could use something other than cinnamon. You could, maybe if you'd like to use taco seasoning or whatever is your pleasure, it might be fun to explore and experiment with different spices with the nuts. Use your imagination and just say, let's try this. Let's see what might work. And maybe you like more of a vanilla taste. Well, you can buy powdered vanilla that maybe you want to add to this mixture. There's all kinds of different things that you can do that are going to be very, very interesting. Now, the recipe says unsalted nuts. And I think that that is very important. So when you use the unsalted nuts, then your flavors of your seasonings become even more emphasized. Learn something new every day. Cooking is a lot of fun. And many times I find that I don't spend a lot of time cooking like I used to because I've got a whole different kind of a lifestyle. But when I have company, everything comes out. I'll pull out recipes, do things, bring things new to the table that I know people have never had before. Or sometimes it's old-time recipes that are just absolutely fabulous. And then again, you have the seasons where you have different vegetables, you have a whole different environment, whether especially if it's hot, like we are having, you know, the warm summer weather. And depending on where you live, it might be very humid, very sticky, depending on where you are. And you want foods that are going to complement the environment of the season. And I will tell you, for those of you that are always concerned about your weight, a client of mine that had been up in Alaska found that she could never lose weight. She said, I've got 30 extra pounds on my body and it just isn't going anywhere. She moved to Hawaii. And in less than 6 months, she lost that 30 pounds. She said, I'm here. I don't feel like eating. She said, I'm happy. I'm just living. I've got sunshine. I am in an environment that is so conducive to my being outside, being active with people. She said, my whole lifestyle has changed. And she said, my eating changed because it was too warm and I was too uncomfortable with eating too much the heavier foods. She said, it just didn't taste good. And that is something that many times our bodies will tell us that. And by golly, when you're up in the far north, your metabolism and everything changes. Believe me, I know. I've been traveling up there for over 40 years, and I will tell you that is exactly what happens, especially when it's bitter, bitter, bitter cold. And that is why when it comes to cooking, when you cook for the season that you're in, it can make all the difference in the world. Donna Sebo here. Well, we're out of time. Oh, my goodness, it goes by so quickly. I'm so delighted we've had this chance for a visit, and you are welcome to come back anytime you like. And remember those archives. Remember also that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless, be well, and we are going to be talking again, and yes, don't forget to check the calendar, because the new listings of guests are always going to be up on that network calendar, and my social media gal will keep you informed. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.